Iran's president says his administration has been successful in controlling soaring inflation, vowing to spare no effort to improve people's livelihoods. Iran condemns abhorrent beating of female Palestinian inmates in an Israeli jail, slamming the U.S. and EU for remaining silent. And around 1,000 British Border Force officers will go on strike next month to join a wave of industrial action sweeping the country. Hello everyone, thanks for tuning in to World News. The Iranian president says his administration has been successful in reining in soaring inflation, promising more work to improve people's living conditions. Ebrahim Raisi said the inflation rate has seen a 20% decline under his watch and currently stands at 40%. The president said recent riots in the country disrupted local markets and pushed up the foreign currency exchange rates. Raisi said his administration seeks to stabilize the market and make sure that people's livelihoods are not affected by fluctuations in the forex markets. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran's ready to advance security and stability in Africa. Hossein Amir Abdollahian was meeting with Mauritania's President Mohamed Oumarzouk in Nouakchott. The Iranian foreign minister said his country stands at the forefront of fighting terrorism. He praised Mauritania's counterterrorism efforts in Western Sahara. Amir Abdollahian said that Tehran supports peace and stability in the region. The Mauritanian president underscored Iran's role in fighting terror and called for the expansion of relations. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman condemned as utterly abhorrent the beating of Palestinian women held in Israeli prisons. Nasser Kanani questioned the way that U.S. and European countries respond to human rights abuses committed by the Israeli regime. Meantime, a Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, said Israeli violations against Palestinian prisoners will not go unpunished. Hamas called on young Palestinians to keep up the resistance against the Israeli regime. On Tuesday, the Israeli prison service placed in solitary confinement Palestinian women imprisoned at the Damon facility. Prison authorities also reportedly assaulted women's representative at the detention center. The Palestinian prisoners languishing in an Israeli jail have resumed a hunger strike for a second straight day now. 120 detainees have been refusing food in protest at inhumane situation of the prison situated in the Negev Desert. Human rights groups have repeatedly expressed concern over the Palestinian treatment there. For years, locked up Palestinians have had no choice but to go on a hunger strike to draw awareness to the violations of their basic rights in Israeli detention. Most Palestinian inmates are held in Israeli prisons with no charge or trial. And for more on the story, we were earlier joined by a Ramallah correspondent, Mona Candio.
120 Palestinian prisoners are continuing their hunger strike against the Israeli practices, the illegal, of course, practices against Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, and mainly for against the Israeli ongoing raids to the cells at any time, transferring Palestinian prisoners from a cell to another and even from jail to another, imposing solitary confinement against Palestinian prisoners. In addition to this, we have to mention that Palestinian prisoners from both the Hamas and Jihad movement had even refused to leave their cells today in a number of Israeli jails like Majiddo, Awfer, and Ad-Damun to protest the illegal Israeli practices against them. And also hundreds of Palestinian prisoners had refused to get their meals today. It's not a hunger strike, but they returned back their meals. It's, of course, a protest. It's a move seen by the Israelis as a challenge by the Palestinian prisoners.
A prominent advocacy group has accused the British government of unlawfully resuming arms sales to Saudi Arabia for possible use in the war on Yemen. The UK-based campaign against arms trade told London High Court government gives arms to the kingdom despite evidence of repeated violations of international humanitarian law. The CAAT also accused the government of caring more about profits than war crimes and the deaths of civilians. The government has acknowledged there had been breaches of humanitarian law by the Riyadh regime, but said that they're isolated cases. UK authorities resumed arms sales to the kingdom in 2020. A court ruling had decided in 2019 sales were unlawful. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen back in March of 2015. Hundreds of thousands of people have been killed since. UK Prime Minister has yet to find a replacement for chairman of his ruling Conservative Party. Nadeem Zahawi was fired over the weekend following weeks of revelations about his tax affairs. Saeed Puriza has your details.
Nadeem Zahawi, the Conservative Party chairman, fallen from grace for not paying his taxes. He received accolades as vaccine minister during the pandemic and even ran for prime minister last year. His downfall began after it emerged he settled nearly a $6 million dispute with the UK's tax collector, HMRC, during his time as chancellor last summer. An inquiry ordered by Prime Minister Rishi Sunak found Zahawi had breached the ministerial code.
Zahawi is out, but now the focus has shifted to the Prime Minister himself. This week, he'll be facing tough questions in the building behind me about how much he knew about Mr. Zahawi's tax affairs and when.
Zahawi's sacking has also acted as a reminder about Rishi Sunak's reinstatement of Suella Braverman as Home Secretary last year, after she resigned for breaching the ministerial code by sending a sensitive official document from her personal email account.
Sunak has said he wanted to have a government of integrity, essentially, and it sends the wrong signals in that sense too. We therefore see a government which is drifting and failing to achieve some of its own specific targets, and that's got to be a worry for the Prime Minister and indeed for their election chances.
Speaking of Boris Johnson, he's been named by his supporters as a potential candidate to replace Nadeem Zahawi.
He's seen as a vote magnet, but he's also a trouble magnet. Most recently, we've seen these questions being asked about the chair of the BBC helping him out with a loan. Nothing has been said about law-breaking, but with all of the other problems the Conservatives have, do they really want to risk Boris Johnson in a position where he could bring more intrigue, let's say?
That, in addition to a parliamentary inquiry into whether Boris Johnson misled the House of Commons over Partygate, lockdown rule-breaking drinking sessions during the pandemic, and an investigation into numerous complaints of bullying by Deputy Prime Minister Dominic Raab. Nadeem Zahawi will be remembered as the minister who played fast and loose with the rules and became the first one to be dismissed by the Prime Minister. But no one's sure if he will be the last. Saeed Puriza, London.
Around 1,000 UK border force officers at English Channel ports are set to walk off the job this month, joining a wave of industrial action over pay. Public and Commercial Services Union said staff at Dover and French ports of Dunkirk and Calais will strike for higher pay between February 17th and the 20th. The PCS said blame for these strikes lies firmly at the feet of ministers who are refusing to put any money on the table. Now, this is hundreds of thousands of British public sector workers, from teachers and civil servants to train drivers and university lecturers, will strike Wednesday in the largest coordinated action in a generation. They're demanding better pay in line with double-digit inflation that has squeezed household budgets. Meanwhile, French police have clashed with protesters in the capital, Paris, and the cities of Rennes as workers stage a second day of nationwide rallies and strikes against the government's pension reform plan. Police try to disperse the crowds using tear gas and water cannons. Hundreds of thousands took to the streets in several cities protesting the reform plan. According to unions, over 2 million workers attended the rallies. Authorities had mobilized over 11,000 police, 4,000 to Paris alone. Strikes have disrupted public transport, schools, and many other sectors. Opinion polls show a substantial majority of French citizens are opposed to the reform, but President Emmanuel Macron intends to go ahead with the plan, arguing that it's vital to ensure the viability of the pension system. Protesters say that they will keep hitting the streets until authorities back down.
I'm not against a reform, but not this one, because it is unequal vis-à-vis workers. We always hit the same ones when there are other solutions that the government did not wish to consider.
We have reached a stage where I wonder if they realize. It's already been 4 years since the yellow vests have been in the street. It's been 4 years since we say that we already have the slab, and here the government continues to encroach on the wallets of the French. I see that there are people, so it's nice, but they really have to realize that we are fed up, really fed up. We won't stop anyway.
Ladies and gentlemen of the government, you are wearing people down. You are using everything we had in our reserves, and now there is no more reserve. There is nothing left, and when the people have nothing left, that's where the anger is the strongest. You are taking away our bread.
This is the second strike in France over the issue in less than 2 weeks. The government said a bill intends to overhaul the pension system and raise the retirement age to 64 from 62, where it's at right now. Government has signaled there could be a wiggle room, though, on some of these measures, but not on the age limit. U.S. officials say Washington is preparing over $2 billion worth of military assistance to Ukraine amid its war with Russia. New package will include longer-range rockets. Officials say it is expected to include support equipment for Patriot air defense systems, precision-guided munitions, and Javelin anti-tank weapons. This is the first time U.S. is providing long-range rockets to Ukraine. A large portion of funding for the new package will come from Washington's Ukraine Security Assistance Initiative. It allows President Joe Biden's administration to get weapons from the U.S. arms industry rather than existing weapon stocks. Russia has always said that Western military support for Ukraine will only prolong the war. European Parliament is desperate to display a unanimous position on arming Ukraine with more lethal weapons. However, some MEPs have called military support to Ukraine as lunacy, which could prolong war with Russia, provoke strong response from Moscow. Jerome Hughes reports out of Brussels.
The decision to send German and American tanks to Ukraine is continuing to generate controversy. Many believe the move will prolong the war, and there's concern as to how Russia might respond. However, at a parliamentary hearing on Tuesday, EU legislators were told the West should go even further.
Russia is attacking Ukraine from Russian territory, so obviously we should provide the Ukrainians with long-range missiles, obviously.
There are a lot of EU lawmakers who agree.
Any delay to supply Ukraine with needed weaponry and ammunition is more lives lost on the battlefield.
Some argue constantly supplying lethal weapons to Ukraine is foolish.
We're prepared to risk nuclear war in order to continue this US-NATO proxy war. It is total madness. And this European Union and the European Parliament have lost the plot. They've lost the run of themselves.
European Union taxpayers have provided 50 billion euro to Kiev since last March.
What happens to all the money we send to Ukraine? Is it just disappearing into individuals' pockets? Even President Zelensky has had to admit there's a big problem with widespread corruption.
A number of legislators would like to see less division within the EU.
Austria and Hungary just decided we will not deliver weapons. Okay, it's their decision. But that shows already some hesitation or some breakup of unity.
Spanish MEP Javier Nart told his colleagues it's, quote, ridiculous to suggest Ukraine can win the war against Russia. For now, the US and Germany have ruled out providing fighter jets to Ukraine. Others, including France, have not. According to many analysts, the risk that the conflict could escalate further and spiral completely out of control has never been greater. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
Now, a new BBC documentary, now banned in India, has renewed tensions between religious communities throughout the Indian world, with clashes between Hindu sympathizers of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and other opposition groups critical of his allegedly divisive leadership. Robert Carter reports.
Tensions between Muslims and Hindus in Britain have risen following the recent release of a new BBC documentary, which explores the rise in Hindu extremist politics in India. and concerns that India's Prime Minister may be facilitating the increased violence against India's religious minorities. Over the weekend, British Hindu protesters condemned the BBC with a series of demonstrations outside their UK offices. In one case, a British Muslim of Kashmiri descent confronted a group of Modi supporters in Birmingham.
Modi is a terrorist! Modi, that's it! Keep it moving, guys! BJP!
Some clashes turned violent, as was seen in Australia, this time between Modi supporters and local Sikhs. The two-part documentary, India, The Modi Question, has not been broadcast in India by the BBC. Despite this, India's federal government banned the film, citing emergency powers under India's controversial information technology laws. An attempt by Indian students to air the programme on Friday in New Delhi led to scuffles and arrests.
Where is our freedom to express? Here we students are not supposed to watch a documentary. If it is hidden, if it is banned, then sure there might be something important in it.
Here in Britain, local activists have expressed concern over the possible spread of the same Hindu supremacist ideology to UK shores.
It's a double standard. When they cry for help, they're seen as the victim. But when we cry for help, we're seen as the aggressors. And the simple fact of the matter is that the extremist Hindu community here in Birmingham, it has been growing, has been growing for some years.
In 2022, two English Midland cities witnessed street clashes between Hindus and Muslims, with locals complaining that the troubles in India had essentially spread via the Indian diaspora to British shores. This new documentary has clearly opened old wounds, which could be traced back to 2002, during the notorious Gujarat pogroms, which left approximately 1,000 Muslims killed. Robert Carter, London.
That's a wrap for your latest. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
European Union ministers have recently sought ways to curb immigration and send more people away. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT noted countries that refuse to accept their nationals back after they are turned away from the EU will face visa restrictions, the bloc's interior ministers warned recently. They urged the European Commission to take action as illegal immigration to the EU reached its highest level since 2016. Support for restricting the number of visas granted to non-cooperative nations is strong among EU member states. Swedish Minister for Migration Maria Malmer claimed after a meeting of interior ministers recently. She said, "We see irregular arrivals increasing. Returning those who are denied asylum to Europe is a very important issue. The current level of returned migrants is not acceptable." Just 21% of 340,000 illegal immigrants refused asylum in 2021 will return to their countries of origin, according to Eurostat data referenced in the meeting. If the political and diplomatic efforts to improve cooperation with third countries do not produce the expected results, the member states call on the Commission to come back with proposals on visa restrictions, the Swedish minister continued. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen agreed that there is a need to intensify the return of illegal migrants, calling for a pilot project that would bounce failed asylum seekers back from the bloc's external borders with the immediate returns. The EU should agree on a list of safe countries where returns are unlikely to put migrants at risk, von der Leyen suggested, also recommending agreements with nations including Bangladesh, Egypt, Pakistan, Morocco, Tunisia, and Nigeria in order to prevent departures in the first place and improve returns where necessary. While the EU previously agreed to restrict visas to countries they considered uncooperative on accepting returned nationals, the only country thus punished so far has been Gambia, whose citizens can no longer obtain multiple entry visas to the EU and must wait longer for those papers. The European Commission has proposed similar penalties for Iraq, Senegal, and Bangladesh. But disagreements among member countries have so far prevented agreement on whether or how to punish anyone else, according to Reuters. EU countries recorded over 330,000 illegal entry attempts last year, border control agency Frontex reported, the most since 2016, on a figure that does not include legal asylum applicants or Ukrainian refugees. More than 80% of these were adult men. Meanwhile, Arab News wrote, while European countries struggle to contain the violence perpetrated by anti-immigrant criminals, including anti-Muslim groups, and deal with the root causes of their violence, little is done to contain their hate speech or Islamophobia. While the overwhelming majority of Europeans reject their violent tactics, the rhetoric is moving from the fringes to the mainstream. Rantings against Islam are gradually becoming common in political campaigns and everyday discourse. This process threatens to normalize hate speech, especially Islamophobia, in many parts of Europe. Confusing incitement with freedom of speech has made it difficult to address this growing threat. However, while freedom of expression is a universal value enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, international agreements have attached duties associated with its exercise. The International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the main human rights instrument adhered to by most countries, seeks to address that balance while it holds that everyone shall have the right to freedom of expression. It adds that the exercise of such a right carries with it special duties and responsibilities. It may therefore be subject to certain restrictions, including for the protection of national security or of public order or of public health or morals. Many countries have included such safeguards in their national laws. While opposition to illegal migration or excessive legal migration is normal and falls within freedom of speech and legitimate political discourse, desecrating The Noble Quran denigrates the faith of about 2 billion people around the world who have nothing to do with these local issues. In the case of Sweden, it has also inflamed ethnic animosities within the country and damaged its reputation and the exercise of its foreign policy, threatening its key security interest. The timing of the recent incident in Stockholm is curious when taking into consideration the geopolitical dimensions, such as the Russia-Ukraine crisis, the changing nature of Sweden's relationship with NATO, and the talks with Turkey on that subject. Such timing raises a question about outside influence on Sweden's Islamophobes and possible foreign manipulation. Christensen condemned the burning of the Noble Quran in Stockholm as deeply disrespectful. He tweeted recently, "Freedom of expression is a fundamental part of democracy, but what is legal is not necessarily appropriate. Burning books that are holy to many is a deeply disrespectful act." He expressed sympathy for all Muslims who are offended by what has happened in Stockholm. Muslim countries and others express outrage at the incident, indicating a universal rejection of the desecration of the Noble Quran as a form of protest or political expression. Muslim governments expressed astonishment that the Swedish authorities had allowed it to take place, stressing that freedom of expression must be exercised in a responsible manner. Hundreds of protests have been held worldwide since the incident. Hate groups such as Patriotic Europeans Against Islam, known as Pegida, have done similar things and agitated against Muslims and Islam in other European countries, including burning a copy of the Noble Quran in Amsterdam recently. Since Pegida was founded in Dresden, Germany in 2014, its extremist views have crept into mainstream political discourse, and the far right has made significant political gains in several European countries, including Sweden. Pegida and similar groups have repeatedly incited against Muslims, stoking irrational fears of being overrun by immigrants, especially Muslims. At times, they use the Noble Quran burning as a lightning rod and a tool to attract attention, rally support, recruit new followers, and incite violence.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends. On the threshold of the birthday anniversary of Imam Muhammad al-Taghi al-Jawad, peace be upon him, the ninth infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, let us hear what he said on hearing when some of the things destined for him did not reach him. Our souls and riches are among the pleasant gifts and the deposited loans of God, who makes us enjoy some of them pleasantly and delightedly, and takes away whatever he wills of rewards and merits. He whose intolerance overcomes his steadfastness will waste his rewards. God protect us against so.
A
IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, self-building. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of self-building in the Islamic lifestyle. It is important that a Muslim must know about himself. He should have the knowledge about himself. And after that, he must analyze himself. And after that, he should strive for the self-building or the self-spiritual building. He must purify himself. He must purify himself so that he can get to the perfection. On the other hand, when we look at the Islamic teachings, Allah also has said in the Quran, لَقَدْ مَنَّ اللَّهُ عَلَى الْمُؤْمِنِينَ. Allah has blessed people. He had gave the favor to the people, or to the mu'mineen, إِذْ بَعْثَ فِيهِمْ رَسُولًا, that he has raised a messenger from themselves. What to do? In order to read the book for them, in order to read the verses, يَتْلُوا عَلَيْهِمْ آيَاتِ. This is the first step. The second step, Allah says, وَيُزَكِّيهِمْ, and to purify them so that they can have the self-building. The third step is وَيُعَلِّمُهُمُ الْكِتَابِ, and to teach them the knowledge of the book, وَالْحِكْمَةِ, and the wisdom. Therefore, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given us the favor that He has raised messengers from ourselves, those messengers who are taking us towards the perfection. Therefore, in order to have the best Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to purify ourselves. It is necessary to strive for the self-building. It is necessary to have this spiritual self-building so that we can achieve the perfection in its true meanings. And we cannot achieve this unless we do not follow the book of God, unless we do not follow the footsteps of the messengers of God, which He raised from ourselves for our guidance. Therefore, it is necessary in the self-building to follow the footsteps of the Prophet and to follow the verses of the Quran, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of self-building in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran has said that He has raised messengers from our own selves so that, number one, they do yatlu alayhim ayati. So we can see that the first step or the first orders for the messengers were to read the verses for the people, to acknowledge people or to tell people about the signs and the verses of God. Therefore, if as a Muslim I want to have a self-building, the first thing that I need to do is yatlu ayat. I need to read the verses of Quran. I need to read the verses of the Quran to know that this book of guidance, what does it say? The second step for the prophets and the messengers were وَيُزَكِّيهِمْ, they used to purify people. After reading the verses, when people knew about the orders of God, then they used to purify them. They used to call them towards the purification. And this is what we need to do. When we read the verses of the book, we know about the halal and haram. We know what things are allowable and what things are forbidden in Islam. Therefore, I will perform the allowable things, I will enjoy the allowable things, and I will avoid the forbidden things. So this is in the Quran, yatlu alayhim. When I read the verses of the Quran, I know about it. And then I can purify myself by avoiding every single evil and by adorning myself with all the goodness. And after that, the next step is when I purified myself, yu'allimuhumul kitaba wal hikmah. This is the next step. that when someone is purified, then the knowledge of book and the wisdom is been given to him as it was given to the prophets, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Somebody is killing Iranian nuclear scientists. Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan murdered along with his driver in broad daylight in Tehran traffic.
One of Iran's top nuclear scientists has been killed in a car bombing in the capital Tehran.
Two motorcyclists tracked the car through Tehran's morning rush hour, lobbing a magnetic bomb right at Roshan. A mission that seemed right out of a spy thriller like Syriana.
It has all the earmarks of an Israeli operation, very sophisticated, very particular, and very effective.
People are killing Iranian nuclear scientists in a very clear pattern. Sir, who do you think is behind it?
We believe that these terrorist attacks are supported by some elements in the, especially within the Israeli regime, as well as some quarters around the world.
And what about Israel? What reaction today?
You know, Diane, we've been looking for responses from Israel all day, and where did we find it? Facebook, with the Israeli Defense Force spokesman saying, I don't know who settled the score with the Iranian scientist, but I am certainly not shedding a tear, not exactly a denial there.
Nuclear scientist Dariush Rezai Nejad was assassinated on the 23rd of July 2011. On the afternoon he died, his wife and five-year-old daughter were in the car with him. He was 32. Fereydoon Abbasi was attacked on the 29th of November 2010 as head of Iran's Atomic Energy Agency on his way to the university where he taught nuclear physics. The 53-year-old survived the attack. He says the fact that Iranian scientists are asked to give so much personal information when they travel speaks volumes in itself. On the same day, and at almost exactly the same time, another assassination attack was being launched on the other side of town. 40-year-old Majid Shahriari was the target. He and his wife were on their way to the university where they both taught, when a bomb was attached to their car. Shahriari was killed, his wife survived, but with serious injuries. She still bears the scars of that day. She says before the attack, they had received many death threats. In the past years, there have been five assassination attacks targeting Iranian nuclear scientists in Iran. Four were successful and one failed. The number of attacks and the way they were launched show a trend. So what entity or entities are responsible for these attacks?
Maximum covert operations to block and disrupt the Iranian program, including taking out their scientists, including breaking up their systems, all of it covertly, all of it deniable. Second, maximum coordination with the Israelis in a way which allows them to maximize their impact in Iran. Third, absolute strategic program comparable to what President Reagan, Pope John Paul II, and Margaret Thatcher did to the Soviet Union, of every possible aspect short of war, of breaking the regime and bringing it down.
Mark Perry is an American intelligence and foreign affairs analyst based in Washington.
These are sophisticated operations. They're not suicide bombings. The most recent incident was a magnetic bomb, so I would say it's clear that it was an outside intelligence agency. And Leon Panetta, our Secretary of Defense, has said he has a pretty good idea of who did it, and I think he was hinting that it was the Israelis.
Iran has been threatened and sanctioned over its nuclear energy program. 5 assassination attacks have been launched on Iranian nuclear scientists, and now the drums of war can be heard coming from the West. So are the countries pressuring Iran really worried about Iran having nuclear power? Or is the problem something else?
Get more on this now from RT's Peter Oliver. Peter, what exactly did Vladimir Putin say?
Well, he was really addressing his standpoint on key foreign policy issues. Iran was also on the lips of the Prime Minister. For a few years now, we've seen criticism of Russia's decision to build a nuclear power plant in Iran. Vladimir Putin saying this, The allegations that Iran was developing nuclear weapons was being used as an excuse to try and initiate regime change in the country.
Public perception is very important in all this. To take such drastic steps against another country, the nations involved have to be geared up to accept such an event. Iran's nuclear energy program has been the center of a lot of Western media attention. It's been labeled a nuclear weapons program, and Israeli director Alex Trayman has made a documentary called Iranium to brand that label on the public psyche.
Ronald Reagan helped a lot with the collapse of the Soviet Union by calling them an evil empire and saying, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
It's very much in the interests of the people of Iran, as well as all of Iran's neighbors and us, for us to do everything humanly possible to get this regime to collapse before it gets a nuclear weapon.
2 + 2 = 4. Israel feels threatened by Iran. It said it would do anything to protect its country. Unlike the United States, the Mossad does not have a prohibition against assassination. Clearly, they want to be able to react to the Iranian threat in any manner they can, up to and including assassinations.
Israel has kept quiet over the assassination of Iranian scientists, but the US, Israel's staunch supporter, has been quite vocal about the whole thing. US presidential candidates say if that's what it takes, so be it.
You have to take whatever steps are necessary to break its capacity to have a nuclear weapon.
And it appears obvious to me that the administration is doing little to nothing. Now, I'm hopeful that some of the things we're seeing with respect to the nuclear program that the United States is involved with, which is, on occasion, scientists working on the nuclear program in Iran turn up dead. I think that's a wonderful thing, Kennedy. I think we should send a very clear message that if you are a scientist from Russia or from North Korea or from Iran and you're going to work on the nuclear program to develop a nuclear bomb from Iran, you are not safe. And if people say, well, you can't go out and assassinate people, well, tell that to Milwaukee. Yeah. Okay? We've done it. We've done it for an American citizen.
I want to categorically deny any United States involvement in any kind of act of violence inside Iran.
various entities are feeding off the political narrative surrounding Iran's nuclear program, from the media to weapons companies. It's a topic that has influenced global prices, is being used as a tool in elections, and even as an excuse for insurance companies that trade in and around Iran to push up prices. And certain groups that have also been fighting against the Iranian government for years have hooked their wagon up to this caravan.
Remember, this all started when we found them enriching uranium in an undeclared fashion. And it happened because somebody told on them. There was an Iranian group that brought forth the information.
A former United Nations weapons inspector in Iraq says Israel and the MKO are collaborating.
The question is, did that information, was it sourced by the MKO itself, or was the MKO used as a vehicle to provide this information to the public? There's reason to believe that in the case of the Natanz information, that this information was actually a product of a third agency, an outside party, Israel. Which developed this intelligence, and then Israel used the MKO as the vehicle to spread this information because of the MKO's past record of having intelligence information relevant to the Islamic Republic.
Do you believe that the Israelis are working with the People's Mujahideen of Iran? Do you believe Israel is working with Iranian dissidents?
I would say this: Iran is highly alert to the possibility of Israelis infiltrating it with false identities, trying to kill people, sabotage the Iranian nuclear project, and therefore it is very hard for Israelis to work in Iran. And it might that unlike the history of most of the history of Israeli intelligence, where these operations were conducted on a, quote, blue and white principle, which is the colors of the flags of Israel, meaning only Israeli citizens, only Jews participate in such an operation. Maybe in Iran, the case is different because Iran is a different territory and very hard to work in. When you got such a territory, you might think to recruit locals upon your own people.
By its own admission, the West considers all the options to be on the table. Threats, sanctions, assassinations, and now the drums of war. Iran says Western think tanks are employing rather feeble strategies and are grossly mistaken in their calculations regarding Iran and the Iranian nation. Of course, the tactics being used against Iran can only succeed if the international community buys into all the hype and propaganda surrounding Iran.
You take a look at Iran and you realize that there's a number of patterns in place that are the exact replica of what had occurred with Iraq. I realized that the United States was playing the exact same game with Iran, manufacturing an artificial crisis over Iran's nuclear weapons program. And then you have a track record of the United States exaggerating a case of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and now you take a look at the case they're making with Iran, and you realize that the same pattern is at play, that the United States is manufacturing a false premise for confronting Iran. For what reason? Regime change.
Mind you, the international community did just that back in 2001 and 2003, when the West attacked Afghanistan and Iraq.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
In the U.S., Memphis police chief on Saturday, 28th of January, disbanded the city's so-called Scorpion Unit, citing a cloud of dishonor from newly released video that showed some of his police officers beating Tyre Nichols to death after stopping the black motorist. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Associated Press has covered this story and tells us more. Memphis Police Director Sarah Lynn C.J. Davis acted a day after a harrowing video emerged, saying she listened to Nichols' relatives, community leaders, and uninvolved police officers in making the decision. Her announcement came as the nation and the city struggled to come to grips with the violence of the police officers, who are also black. The video renewed doubts about why fatal encounters with law enforcement keep happening despite repeated calls for change. Protesters marching through downtown Memphis, Tennessee, cheered when they heard the unit had been dissolved. One protester said the unit that killed Tyre Nichols had been permanently disbanded, referring to the heinous actions of a few that dishonored the unit. Sarah Lynn Davis contradicted an earlier statement that she would keep the unit. She said it was imperative that the department take proactive steps in the healing process. It is in the best interest of all to permanently deactivate the Scorpion unit, she said in a statement. She said the police officers currently assigned to it agreed unreservedly. The unit is composed of three teams of about 30 police officers whose stated aim is to target violent offenders in areas beset by high crime. It had been inactive since Nichols' January 7th arrest. Scorpion stands for Street Crimes Operations to Restore Peace in Our Neighborhoods. In an interview on Friday, 27th of January, with the Associated Press, Sarah Lynn Davis had said she would not shut down a unit if a few officers commit some egregious act, and because she needed it to continue to work. The whole idea that the Scorpion unit is a bad unit, I just have a problem with that, Davis said then. Davis became the first black female chief in Memphis, Tennessee, 1 year after George Floyd was killed at the hands of Minneapolis police. At the time, she was chief in Durham, North Carolina, and had called for sweeping police reform. Ben Crump and Antonio Romanucci, lawyers for the Nichols family, said the move was a decent and just decision. We must keep in mind that this is just the next step on our journey for justice and accountability, as clearly this misconduct is not restricted to these specialty units. It extends so much further, they said. The five disgraced police officers, Tadarius Bean, Demetrius Haley, Desmond Mills, Emmett Martin III, and Justin Smith, have been fired and charged with murder and other crimes in Tyre Nichols' death, which came 3 days after the arrest. They face up to 60 years in prison if convicted of second-degree murder. The video images released on Friday, 27th of January, show police savagely beating the 29-year-old FedEx worker for 3 minutes while screaming profanities at him in an assault that the Nichols' family legal team had likened to the infamous 1991 police beating of Los Angeles motorist Rodney King. Tyre Nichols calls out for his mother before his limp body is propped up against a squad car and the police officers exchange fist bumps. The video also left many unanswered questions about the traffic stop and about other law enforcement officers who stood by as Tyre Nichols lay motionless on the pavement. Davis has said other police officers are under investigation, and Shelby County Sheriff Floyd Bonner said two deputies were relieved of their duties without pay while their conduct is being investigated. Rodney Wells, Tyre Nichols' stepfather, said the family would continue to seek justice and those who fail to render aid are just as culpable as the police officers who threw the blows. Cities nationwide had braced for demonstrations after the video emerged on Friday, but protests were scattered and nonviolent. Several dozen demonstrators in Memphis, Tennessee, blocked the Interstate 55 bridge that carries traffic over the Mississippi River towards Arkansas. Protesters also blocked traffic in New York City, in Los Angeles, California, and in Portland, Oregon. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered this story and tells us more. The Memphis Police Department has disbanded a special police unit linked to the death of Ty Nichols, a 29-year-old black man who was pulled over for an alleged traffic violation earlier this month and fatally beaten by five police officers. The decision on Saturday, 28th of January, follows the release of harrowing video footage showing the police officers punching, kicking and hitting Ty Nichols with a baton in scenes that have sparked a renewed debate over police brutality in America, also racism and the need for police reform. Memphis Police Chief Sherilyn Davis said she had listened to the Nichols family, to community leaders and members of the so-called Scorpion Police Unit, from which the five police officers charged over Nichols' death were deployed, and deactivated the unit in the best interests of all. The Street Crimes Operation to Restore Peace in Our Neighborhoods was established in Memphis, Tennessee in 2021 to target violent offenders in areas of high crime. While the heinous actions of a few cast a cloud of dishonor on the title Scorpion, it is imperative that we, the Memphis Police Department, take proactive steps in the healing process, said Sherilyn Davis. She said the department would take every measure possible to rebuild trust that had been negatively affected by the death of Ty Nichols. Ty Nichols, who was father of a 4-year-old son, died 3 days after being hospitalized following the beating delivered by five police officers who were also black on 7th of January this year. The officers were subsequently fired from their jobs and, on Thursday, indicted by a grand jury for second-degree murder, among other charges. The video footage released on Friday, 27th of January, showed in graphic detail how a police traffic stop turned into a savage beating that led to the hospitalization of Ty Nichols and later his death. Nichols was recorded telling officers, "I didn't do anything," as he was pulled from his car. After being pushed to the ground, where he was seen complying with police officers' requests, Nichols was shown running away. A separate video captured minutes later showed two police officers holding Nichols from behind while a third police officer punched him several times in the face before a fourth beat him with a baton. Nichols is heard screaming, "Mum!" repeatedly. The release of the video footage sparked concerns among authorities that there could be a repeat of the nationwide riots and violent protests against police brutality following the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota in May of 2020. George Floyd, a black man, died after a white police officer knelt on his neck for more than 9 minutes, an incident that was also captured on video. But demonstrations held in several U.S. cities on Friday were mostly peaceful, with only a handful arrests and some minor incidents reported by the authorities.